From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I will talk about racism and bigotry in a global context in light of this week's events involving OU's chapter of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity.
We may not be able to empathize entirely with other groups. In fact, we probably can't. But we can begin to see how they view things or to try to understand. And that's only going to happen if we converse, if we interact.
Then I'll talk with journalist and activist Hannah Storm about how much protection reporters can reasonably expect as modern warfare evolves.
I mean, is it worthwhile saying to the Islamic State militia, oh, by the way, guys, you know, we're going to take you to The Hague if you kill a journalist? Probably not.
Those conversations in this half hour. But first, these news headlines. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, it's been a tough and enlightening week here at the University of Oklahoma. And in light of what we've experienced this week, what we've been seeing and witnessing and feeling, and let's take a moment to reflect on this issue more broadly around the world. Obviously, issues of prejudice and racism and bigotry is not just something we see here in Oklahoma or in Norman at the University of Oklahoma. We see this, unfortunately, in many places around the world. It doesn't take long to find examples and evidence. Obviously, anti-Semitic behavior around the world, Islamic hatred, Islamic extremism, Islamophobia, the history of apartheid and racial separation and, you know, a lack of access to political and other voice, the caste system in India and in other locations, systems of superiority and inferiority. And all of these things are very front and center in our minds this week. What are your thoughts?
I think they're front and center in our minds this week for sure, but I think that they have also been front and center in our minds as we do the show on a weekly basis. Many of the examples that you're pointing out are things that we address, particularly in the roundtable. We can think about the situation in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo situation, which ended up having very anti-Semitic overtones, or even in Copenhagen recently. You mentioned Islamophobia. We certainly have seen a great deal of that. And even in this country, there was a case in Dallas, I believe, last week, where a man was shot on his porch watching the snow. And so these sorts of situations are happening. They are things that we should always be reflecting upon and thinking about. And I think one of the things that we've discussed is that a large part of this discussion has been about race, but we see discrimination in all sorts of different ways in every corner of the world, whether it's about religion or race or ethnicity or even socioeconomics. I think those things are all important to consider as well.
Gender, sexual orientation. I mean, there are lots of categories. There are people categorize them and then treat them differently and hold certain ideas about them. And that's the fundamental here, right, is that it isn't just about race. It is a broader problem and issue. But at some point, we must focus, I would presume, less on the people that do these things and more on the problem itself, the structure of society, the kind of societal mechanisms, the socialization process, things that allow these things to perpetuate, the violence that comes out of it, focusing on the violence and reactions to the violence. I mean, the situations in our own country, in like Ferguson, for example, that, you know, resulted just this week in police being targeted in Ferguson. And then, of course, police were being targeted in New York City, I believe it was. So there seems to be efforts to retaliate. And so that is the question, is like moving forward, I guess. And if we need to move forward. And so how do we do that, to focus on the problem and prevent these types of things from happening in the first place? What are some of the solutions that we can see emerging around the world?
Well, obviously, it's hard to find solutions here. These are issues that are deeply ingrained. They are histories long, depending on where you're looking. Could be a history of colonial rule. It could be a history of civil war. These sorts of things create divergence and difference, and that creates anger and in many cases, violence, which is unfortunate. I think perhaps it's helpful to think about institutional discrimination, so laws that actually discriminate against certain peoples. And we can certainly fight that and push for those laws to change or try to get institutions to change. But it becomes much deeper when we're talking about the social differences or those things that influence the institutions, trying to get people to change. And I think one of the most important things we have to do is continue to have a conversation. Be open to that conversation. We at a university have the opportunity to talk with young people on a daily basis. We need to continue to do that and not shy away from these sorts of issues. We need to educate people, be they at the university or elsewhere, and we need to connect. I think that's something that we both believe very strongly in, that we need to put ourselves in the shoes of other individuals. We may not be able to empathize entirely with other groups. In fact, we probably can't, but we can begin to see how they view things or to try to understand. And that's only going to happen if we converse, if we interact.
Well, are there some specific activities? I think the United Nations and other organizations have been engaging for some time on, you know, Worldwide Anti-Discrimination Day, for example. These things are not necessarily well known. They're not well highlighted, and you know, and so far above our local level that it's hard to even see how they'll make a difference here. But are these kinds of things what it will take to kind of bring us together?
I think that's a step. You mentioned an Anti-Discrimination Day. Yes, next week, March 21st, which I doubt many of us knew, is actually the UN-proclaimed International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And there's going to be a series of events in this country and around the world, an opportunity for policymakers to get together and discuss these issues, as well as for your average citizen to get together and discuss these issues. So those sorts of things have been in place. They are going to continue to be in place. And we need to take it upon ourselves to seek them out and to let others know that they're happening so we can participate.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing some thoughts about this. We will be and should be continuing this conversation well into the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. You can leave comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. And while you're there, you can also find all of the station's local coverage of the SAE story. You can find this program on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, and Rebecca and I tweet at Cruz226 and at Suzette Grelot. In just a minute, I'll talk about how the evolution of modern warfare has changed the role of war reporters and affected their safety. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. This half hour, I'm joined by Hannah Storm. She served as the director of the International News Safety Institute since 2010. Before that, she worked as a journalist for Reuters, the BBC, and the Times of London, covering Latin America and Haiti. She edited her organization's 2012 book, No Woman's Land, on the front lines with female reporters, that was inspired by the attack on CBS reporter Lara Logan in Tahrir Square. Hannah Storm, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Well, Hannah, you work in the field of journalism, and particularly regarding safety and security issues. You've done a lot of work in post-conflict zones, after natural disasters, areas of the world, humanitarian crises, places where, you know, it's not necessarily safe for people to be coming in and reporting on stories there. You're enlightening us as to what's going on in these situations. And so you've developed this approach to enhance safety and security for other journalists. But first, can you tell us kind of why are we even having to focus on this? What is it about journalists in particular that puts them in unsafe and insecure positions?
Well, I work for a charity called the International News Safety Institute, or otherwise known as INSEE, and it was set up 12 years ago, round about the start of the Iraq War in 2003. And the reason it was set up that was that there wasn't a really specific organisation trying to promote the safety of journalists, trying to proactively work with journalists to help them understand the risks they faced and mitigate those risks as well. As we've seen over the last 12 years, every year there are large numbers of journalists who get killed. Every year, most of the time, we don't hear about most of those journalists. We only hear about the big names.
So how many do we lose in a given year?
On average, it's two journalists and media workers dying every week. It's about 100 a year. There have been a little over that on average over the last 12 years. I was counting before, and it's around about 1,500 journalists since 2003, and they die in all manner of difficult, dangerous and awful places. Some of them are targeted for the work they do, and that's often the case with local journalists. So in places like Mexico or Somalia or Honduras and places like that. But also sometimes it's going on dangerous assignments, and it might be something like, you know, being in the wrong car at the wrong time. It might be something like when Anthony Shadid died, you know, something like that. He, you know, his was a health issue, but he was on an assignment where he happened to pass there. And it's a very difficult situation and environment that journalists work in. The reason it's so important that we try and work with them to protect them and help them understand the risks they face is obviously they are providing a voice to the voiceless. They're providing truth. They're shining a light in the dark corners of society. Without journalists, we wouldn't have any way of seeing these things. So aside from the numbers of journalists who are killed, you know, the two every week, there are many, many more journalists who are attacked, assaulted, threatened, kidnapped, detained. And what we seem to be seeing in this day and age, and particularly since the start of the Arab uprisings, say 4.5, 5 years ago, is that there seems to be many more attacks on journalists. There seems to have been a change with regard to, we used to be respected, much more respected, and now it's kind of almost, as you say, open season for attacks on journalists.
Well, I do want to get to this issue of it becoming more serious now. I mean, the numbers you just quoted are astonishing, and that this many journalists have died in the line of duty, basically. I mean, you think, I have this image in my head of, you know, the press used to wear around their credentials because it protected them, because it was, you can't touch them, they're a member of the press, they're not involved. But now it's just the opposite, it seems. And so this does seem to be something new, although not brand new. I mean, you quoted figures going back to 2003, since the beginning of the Iraq War. I presume that we had journalists in harm's way before that. I know this is the case, for example, throughout the Balkan Wars in the 90s and wars in Africa. So it's not brand new, but it's certainly picking up steam. And so what has happened here? You said there are lots of reasons that help us understand and explain what has happened.
Sure. There's a couple of things I'd say is there used to be this sense that journalists were immune, that journalists were somehow protected, that journalists were somehow sitting on a pedestal. That's certainly not the case now. Although, as I mentioned before, journalists, local journalists as we call them, journalists working in countries far afield on stories that we very rarely even hear about in the international media, they bear the brunt of this, and they've always borne the brunt of it. So most of the journalists dying overseas are journalists, as I say, working in places like Mexico, covering the drugs wars, in Somalia, covering conflicts which don't make it into the big news. And that's about 90% of the journalists who die every year. And of those, 90% of those, their killers are never brought to justice. In my mind, the way it's changing is it seems to be that there seems to be more of a focus on targeting and attacking international journalists recently. And that's been over the last couple of years. As I said before, you know, we used to have the sense that journalists were immune. Now it seems like open season. Journalists are not allowed to be attacked and assaulted. There's a Geneva Convention that basically says that journalists should be protected in the same way that civilians are protected. So journalists are civilians. There is some talk now that maybe we need to reconsider that and have a special war crime. So basically it's a war crime if you do target journalists. Now, there are various many different reasons as to whether that should be the case or whether actually it's even going to put off people who target journalists. I mean, is it worthwhile saying to the Islamic State militia, oh, by the way, guys, you know, we're going to take you to The Hague if you kill a journalist? Probably not. But it's been a really interesting kind of period of time. So just briefly, I guess the reasons why it's changed in the past 4 years or so is that the rise of social media has really increased the number of voices and platforms for news out there. That it basically means that anybody can be a journalist. And also it means that outfits who aren't traditionally journalists can use it as a form of propaganda. So, you know, they can say bad things about journalists and use journalists to say bad things. There's also the conflicts of the last 4 to 5 years have been very easy geographically to reach for many journalists. So it's quite easy to get to the Middle East, for instance, to get into Egypt, to get into Tunisia, to get into Libya. Less easy to get into Syria, but still kind of easy, although I wouldn't advise it, absolutely. And there's a couple of other points. Is equipment that can be used by journalists is also much more affordable than it was in the past. And you can effectively be a journalist just with your iPhone. And the final thing is the economics of journalism. Over the past few years, bureaus have been cut massively around the world. So most of the major news organizations have really sliced the numbers of overseas bureaus. That's left a vacuum for journalists who, you know, the kind of guys who they used to employ, the foreign correspondents are no longer there. There's a reliance on the local journalists. And there's also a vacuum that freelancers are going in to fill. Added to that, on the economic side, when people are going to journalism school, when they come out of journalism school, there's no jobs for them. So they want to go and try and sometimes, you know, do some journalism because they don't want to be stacking shelves at supermarkets. They think, hey, look, I can add all those factors in and I can go and cover the Middle East. I'd say to them, that is not the place to cut your teeth. So that is one of the reasons. It's kind of like a perfect storm, all those different elements as to why it's becoming incredibly insecure to be a journalist.
My guest is Hannah Storm, the director of the International News Safety Institute. Right after this break, I'll talk with her about some of the challenges specifically faced by female journalists. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been speaking with Hannah Storm, the Director of the International News Safety Institute, and the editor of the book No Woman's Land, On the Front Lines with Female Reporters. Help us understand how all of these things that you just described and the targeting of or the use of the lack of respect for journalists in general is different in particular for female journalists and what the challenges are for you as somebody who's focusing on safety and security of journalists and helping train journalists. What are the things that you're helping female journalists do in particular?
Well, the reason we started at INSEE focusing on the idea of the safety of women journalists was after the attack on Lara Logan, the CBS correspondent, in Tahrir Square in Egypt in February 2011, at the start of the Egyptian Revolution. It kind of opened a new chapter in the discussion about the safety of women journalists. There were a lot of questions being asked. There were a lot of people coming to us to ask for advice and tips on how to stay safe. But there were also a lot of questions about, should women be out on the front lines? You know, should they as mothers be out on the front lines? Really, were they being responsible? Now, people sit on different sides of the fence in that debate, and I'm a female journalist, and my personal belief is that everybody ought to have a choice to do as they feel fit themselves, and that nobody should be forced to do something if they don't want to, and also that they shouldn't be judged on those choices. But the upshot of that whole conversation about safety and journalism was that we were inundated by comments and questions and stories from other female journalists around the world. And I decided from that to try and create a resource for other women journalists who wanted some information about how to stay safe and also the kind of experiences they'd had. It might not be, for instance, that the challenges they faced were any worse than their male colleagues. It might have been that being a woman journalist, it actually opened many more doors. So we pulled together 40 stories from journalists from around the world. It's a fantastic collection of these stories from people from the BBC and CNN. Lara Logan did the foreword for it. Hala Gharani from CNN wrote for it. Jennifer Griffin from Fox News wrote for it. And they told us about the kind of experiences they'd had as women and as journalists, the kind of doors that had been opened because of their work and because of their gender, and some of the problems and challenges they'd faced as well. And it somehow inadvertently made us an expert in that area. Obviously, it was a passion of mine because I was born female and I'm a journalist as well. But it's been really helpful because what we've been able to do over the course of this 2-3 year period is work specifically with journalists in areas of the world where they're incredibly challenged because of their gender and the cultural issues around their gender, to help train them to better stay safe, really.
So given these challenges, how and why is it that journalists then continue to do this work? I mean, obviously the passion, the professionalism, the commitment to, as you said earlier, giving a voice to the voiceless and making sure that we know about and are aware of all of the horrible things in some respects that are going on around the world. But you also mentioned, you know, these killers of journalists are never brought to justice. I mean, there are all kinds of safety and security concerns. So why do people, despite this, continue to go down this path? I know you've talked about economics. I know you've talked about the fact there are just more people out there doing this kind of work and it's easy given the access. But is there anything else kind of fundamentally influencing these decisions that there's, you know, as you said, in the rise of social media, that you can make a name for yourself, that there's a real strong need or desire, or is it really just, you know, strong passion?
I honestly think it is. I mean, yes, there are certain people out there who want to make their name. And yes, as in every profession and every career, there are people who perhaps go in with the wrong motivations. But nearly every single journalist I know feels completely compelled that it's not a profession, it's a vocation. They have a desire, and sometimes it's an idealistic and sometimes it's a naive desire, but they want to shine that light into these dark places, and they want to tell the story behind the headlines. And as I said, they want to give a voice to the voiceless. It's not dangerous for everybody, let me make that clear. And even after 15 years, and even after, you know, 15 years of seeing some fairly grim stuff in my life, I wouldn't choose a different career at all. It's allowed me to see the world. It's allowed me to make friends in places that I'd never anticipated going. And it's allowed me to make friends with strangers and certainly be able to help my family understand how important it is to kind of carry on, you know, telling those stories as well. So I think it's a combination of all of those. And I would certainly say that we shouldn't be paralyzed by fear in terms of the kind of the safety thing. It is important. It's absolutely valid that we understand the role that journalists play and the safety considerations. But I think above and beyond that, we have an enormous responsibility to try and tell the truth in as close a proximity to that truth as we can find, and be the kind of the fourth estate, that first draft of history.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for being with us today and helping us shine light on this important issue of media safety. As we know that media workers are out there shining light on those important issues, it's important for us to keep in mind that they put themselves in harm's way so that we can see those things. So thank you for being with us today and sharing that.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Hannah Storm, the director of the International News Safety Institute. There's more information about the organization on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our producer is Brian Hardzinski, Sam Dupre writes our web content, and Symphony Swift oversees our research and books the guests. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.